From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The first Democratic primary debate was hosted by CNN and Facebook this week. And by now, you've no doubt heard that it was a total drubbing.
Hillary Clinton dominated.
Hillary Clinton hit a home run.
Hillary Clinton was tough last night. She really dominated.
That's right. The punditocracy has spoken. Hillary, though besieged by the GOP and maybe the FBI on her squirrely email practices, showed up with a can of whoop-ass and toppled her opponents like so many wobbly duck pins.
She knew how to bring it, and I thought she was kind of in control and in command pretty much throughout.
The problem is, others with an interest in the matter didn't see it that way. One of many to object to the Hillary triumph narrative was Sean Spicer, communications director for the Republican National Committee.
Focus group after focus group and social media stat after social media stat shows that Bernie Sanders was the clear winner.
The RNC, of course, would love its eventual nominee to face not Clinton in the general election, but instead, say, a geriatric Jewish socialist from Vermont.
First, we're going to explain what democratic socialism is.
But the same sentiments have been bandied all over the internet by the Republicans' ideological opposites, Sanders supporters, who not only think Bernie stole the show, but think CNN and the rest of the media are suppressing the debate's true outcome to serve their own corrupt interests. It's idiotic. Media lockstep is a sign of laziness, not corporate corruption. But news organizations that sponsored focus groups and online polls deserved whatever backlash they got, especially CNN, which aired the debate and made its focus group a central part of the coverage.
We asked people to live vote during the debate. Who is winning the debate overall? There you go. 75%. That is by a huge margin that they believe that Sanders was winning the debate.
How many of you, again, raise your hands, think that Bernie Sanders won this debate? Most of you. Okay.
Of course, as CNN well knows, those raised hands do not constitute data. They do not project actual voting. Focus groups yield an insight here and there, but have zero statistical relevance. If CNN had filled those seats with the next 20 people in line, 75% of those volunteers might have been cheering on Hillary. The next 20 might have coalesced in support of Lincoln Chafee.
Glass-Steagall was my very first vote. I just arrived. My dad had died in office. I was appointed to the office. I think we'd get some takeovers.
Okay, maybe not him. The point is, unscientific polls are literally meaningless, and social media tallies tell us little more. Twitter traffic and Google searches, for instance, tilted heavily toward Bernie Sanders Tuesday. But why? Because he won the debate, or because he was a new face to millions? So be careful of leaping to conclusions, and certainly judge nothing, based on the obligatory post-debate spin room, where preordained answers to stupid questions indicate nothing but cable news's reliance on fake expertise and fake drama. Here's Martin O'Malley's campaign manager, Dave Hamrick.
Clearly, Governor O'Malley delivered tonight. The expectations were high. He sounded presidential. He looked presidential.
Picking the winner is not only a fool's errand, it's the wrong question. A debate isn't an election. There isn't necessarily a single winner or loser. In this case, there were probably four winners. Hillary, for being poised, informed, and presidential. Sanders, for exciting his followers and vastly broadening his profile. Martin O'Malley, for being handsome, articulate, more experienced than we might have thought, and handsome, paving the way for who knows what. And maybe the Democratic Party as a whole, just for displaying grown-ups debating issues. Lincoln Chafee, however, did lose. No, seriously, that poor man totally lost.
For Sanders and his supporters, the apparent snubbing by editors and commentators is just more proof of what he's been saying all along. The mainstream media are not to be trusted and remain out of touch with what matters to the American people. Here's Sanders during the debate on Tuesday.
And let me say something about the media as well. I go around the country, talk to a whole lot of people.
The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America.
Paul Hines, political editor for the Vermont-based 7 Days, says the media have never really noticed how Sanders sees them because they've never really bothered to peer past the surface of his disdain.
The grumpy grandpa trope has been everywhere.
You go see Bernie Sanders, and he's cranky.
Older, angry, cranky sometimes.
You know, slightly cantankerous, but appealing, grandfatherly.
You know, there's another side to that. I spoke to a number of his current and former staffers for a story about the way that he's run his own Senate office and his prior offices. And I spoke to a number of people who referred to him as rude, short-tempered, and occasionally downright hostile. One former staffer said that as a supervisor, he was, quote, unbelievably abusive. There's sort of a story you hear a lot in Vermont political circles of Bernie Sanders on his way to a town hall meeting, harassing his staff about how many hot dog buns they ordered. He believes in himself so strongly. He works very hard. He drives his staff very hard. But I think sometimes he may go a little bit too far.
Now, you've suggested that the national media, when they characterize him as grumpy and cantankerous, miss the fact that what he's really grumpy and cantankerous about is them.
That is one of the many things he's grumpy and cantankerous about. In just about every race that he's run, people have said, well, there's no way Bernie Sanders can win. So he's really despised the media.
Here's a piece of tape of him in 1985 when he was mayor of Burlington at a conference called Does the Media Lie?
Now, obviously, you would be very excited if we stood on our heads and held a press conference swimming in the lake, because that would be a news story. Be very exciting. We saw, that's not absurd. That's what's news. 5 lunatics today were swimming in the ice-cold water of Lake Champlain, and all the news media was there, and they talked about tax reform while you were there.
Senator Sanders wants you to show up to his press conferences and write, Senator Sanders wants to end childhood poverty. And when we don't write that story, he thinks that we're shallow. What I think he misses is that it's actually not news for Senator Sanders to come out against childhood poverty. So naturally, we are interested in asking him about other issues, and he will refuse to answer questions on those. He'll literally ignore the question or sometimes leave the room at the end without answering them.
We have tape of political reporter Peter Frain, then at the Vanguard Press, an independent paper, 30 years ago, making pretty much that same point.
I asked the mayor when he said, any other questions? Yes, I have a question. It's not on the electric rates. It's about Nicaragua. And you got up, and which is the best move you have in terms of a politician manipulating the news. You've mastered the art. When you're asked a question you don't want to answer, you leave the room. You got up and walked right out of here.
Well, he's gotten even better at it since then. You know, I was joking with a former reporter from Vermont, wondering if it would actually be possible to write a news story that Bernie Sanders would like. And we agreed that really the only story that he would like is the press release that his people wrote, reprinted in a newspaper. That's the only thing that he would see as true journalism. One thing that's interesting about Senator Sanders is that for all the railing against the press that he does, he spends almost every day trying as hard as he can to be in the press. He's done this throughout his career. He's done a very effective job at appearing at MSNBC every night, getting his message across.
And his supporters praise him for exactly that. He has a stunning level of consistency.
He does. He has been making the same point for 40 years.
We can go down memory lane right now. In 1985, here he is addressing a workers' pride forum.
And the myth of what the system tells us is that we're all together. Well, we're not all together. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
And here he is in 1993 speaking to a nearly empty House of Representatives.
The wealthiest 1% of our population owns 37% of the wealth of America. That is significantly more than
And here he is last month on Late Night with Colbert.
It is a moral outrage that the top 1/10 of 1% today owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
He said that his wife sometimes calls him Johnny One Note. And he said, you know what, that's fine. Quote, nobody understands how bad it is. And he's referring to income inequality. That's why I think if I were on television or radio 24 hours a day saying nothing else other than that, it would be a contribution. But on other issues, he really just isn't so comfortable talking about. For instance, his record on gun rights. He's really not made clear a coherent, consistent philosophy. It kind of depends on what the issue of the day is. So after the Aurora, Colorado shootings in July 2012, he told local newspapers that decisions about gun control should be made as close to home as possible at the state level. And then after the Newtown shootings, he was radio silent. We requested interviews with him and weren't granted one for almost 3 months. By that point, he had publicly embraced Obama's assault weapons ban and had really done a total 180. But when I sat down with him, he really didn't want to talk about it. And I'm not sure it's necessarily that he's flip-flopping. I think it's more that he just doesn't really care about that issue so much, and so he's not really sure exactly how he feels.
There is one area in which he and lots of candidates do seem to be on the same page, and that is they're running against the system. But Bernie's been a politician for decades. Do you think he's really outside it?
This is a guy who has been in Congress since 1990. So certainly he has been a part of the system, but he hasn't been at the center of that system. I mean, if you look at him down in the U.S. Congress, you know, he's eating alone at the cafeteria table.
Is he really?
Yeah, he is. He really is. You know, he has sort of learned how to play well with others a little bit better over the years. When he ran for the Senate, he agreed to caucus with Senate Democrats and was eventually made a committee chair, which is a pretty remarkable thing for a guy who railed against the Democratic Party in Burlington in the 1970s and the 1980s. But, you know, to say that he's some sort of inside player in Washington, I think would be totally incorrect.
Do you think he sits alone because he's just not fun to eat with?
I haven't shared a meal with him, so it's hard for me to say.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Hines is the political editor for the Vermont-based 7 Days. You can find its Bernie archive at berniebeat.com. And Paul Hines is also a former OTM intern.
We got up here and we did our press conference, and I thought it went pretty well. Not one word of the press conference on tax reform was in the paper. The headline of the paper is, Sanders still not sure whether he's going to run for governor. People keep thinking that I must be a total idiot having press conferences every day announcing I haven't yet decided whether I'm running for governor. What's the matter with this idiot? Why does he have to have a press conference to announce he doesn't know whether... Well, I don't.
The Gallup organization has been among the most famous and the most trusted names in polling since 1936, when it predicted Franklin D. Roosevelt would defeat Alf Landon for the presidency. So, by all rights, a mad scramble for presidential nominations should be Gallup's busy season. But remarkably, last week, Gallup said it would no longer conduct national polls on primary candidates because such polls are essentially a waste of resources. So it'll be polling on issues instead. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Frank, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It has been 80 years of track announcing. Why stop calling the horse race now?
We are doing a lot of other things relating to the election, but it's a matter of priorities after all these 80 years going all the way back to 1936. To spend a lot of time and a lot of effort asking people at this point who they're going to vote for if the election were held today didn't seem to us to be the best use of our time and our resources. We can spend more time trying to explore what images of the candidates are filtering through to the people, why their preferences might be changing, and also, very importantly, what are the issues that Americans want them to be discussing, and how are Americans reacting to the proposals that the candidates put forth?
Gallup is a so-called gold standard pollster. It uses industry best practices for sample selection, for conducting interviews live as opposed to getting some online checklist filled out and so forth. But we are awash in less rigorous polls, some of which apparently fudge their results to conform to results from pollsters using gold standard methodologies. When you leave the field, what will happen to overall accuracy in the industry, and what will it mean to news consumers?
Well, that's a good question, but there are a number of firms out there who have very good methodology. All of us, individuals who are engaged in public opinion polling, have different motivations and different objectives. The university polls, the college polls, like Quinnipiac or Monmouth or Marist College, they're out there asking the horse race. But one of their motivations is to increase the name ID for their university and their institutions, which has worked quite well. Let me mention another one, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. One of their objectives is to provide Chuck Todd with some information that he can begin Meet the Press with on Sunday morning. So they have different objectives and different reasons for doing what they're doing than we do. But they're a very good poll, and there will be horse race numbers out there for people who are interested in them.
We're speaking on Wednesday, calling your attention to last night's Democratic debate on CNN. It was strikingly different from the Republican debates in that the candidates actually discussed policy and issues compared to the Republican debates, which to me were much more of a toga party. And the Republican debates had historically high levels of audience. CNN apparently broke a record for viewership on a Democratic debate, but not touching the interest in the Trumpapalooza. I'm wondering if the media will pay attention to issues polling the way it laps up horse race polling, and whether the public will be as interested in what your numbers have to say when it's a question of immigration policy versus whether the Donald is outpolling Ben Carson.
One of the things that we will be doing is taking a lot of the proposals that the candidates made. Let me give you an example. Both Sanders and Hillary Clinton came out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership as part of the debate. And so we will look at where do these candidates fit with what the public thinks should be done, and where does the public not? I've already put out a publication looking at the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The data show actually that we don't find a lot of support for the idea that the U.S. should get out of that. So right there, we're able to tell the candidates and tell the public that, in fact, these two Democratic candidates have adopted a position which is out of sync with the American public.
Historically, the press has really done a terrible job understanding what the numbers actually say, how the margin of error and sample size influence the reliability and so forth. I wonder if there's any reason to think that the press's reporting on issue-based polls will be any better than its reporting on the candidate-based ones.
You've got an excellent point. There are organizations and entities that do a very solid job, and then there are a lot of others that simply look for the latest headline and don't have the knowledge or the interest in trying to really put that in some context. We'll wait and see. One of the things we do at Gallup is publish a lot of this on Gallup.com, our own website. So we hope that a lot of consumers will come and kind of get it from the horse's mouth so that it doesn't have to always be filtered through secondary and tertiary sources.
Well, you know, on this point, Gallup has recently had some notable failures. Most notoriously, in the last presidential election, your final poll put Mitt Romney ahead of Barack Obama. In point of fact, as I understand it, your final poll showed that Romney is ahead by 1 point. But the margin of error was significant enough that you did not exactly predict the race for Romney, did you?
We absolutely did not. We said it looks to us like the race is too close to call. In fact, Obama won in the popular vote by close to 4%, which is still fairly close, but clearly away from a dead heat. The average of all the polls actually had it closer to being a dead heat than it did towards the actual margin that Obama got. So something was going down there, probably relating to turnout, that affected the final result that most pollsters were not able to get in terms of making that final prediction.
Has Gallup decided what it's going to do after the nominees have been identified to track the race for the presidency?
No, we have not. In 2012, we tracked on a nightly basis who would you vote for. We clearly won't do that this time. We're not going to devote a lot of that kind of resources to that. But exactly what we'll do in terms of asking the horse race on an occasional basis and so forth and so on, we haven't decided. We'll still be talking about that and probably will as we go into the new year.
Well, I wish you luck. In all your endeavors, I myself am going to take to my bed for the next 13 months and live with whatever I wake up to.
Hopefully the will of the people will do what's best for the country.
Frank, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup.
Coming up, a big decision in Europe offers some hope for the future of privacy.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Europe's highest court ruled last week on a digital privacy case that U.S. officials say threatens the economy of the global internet. It's thanks to a young man whose unexpected discovery sent him into the media spotlight.
Meet Max Schrems. He's the current thorn in the side of internet giants like Facebook, Amazon, and Google.
Europe's highest court has ruled in favor of an Austrian law student who claims a transatlantic data protection agreement doesn't adequately protect consumers.
The highest court in Europe struck down a transatlantic data pact used by about 4,500 companies.
It all began about 5 years ago when Schrems was an exchange student in California. Some tech company lawyers visiting his class planted the seed of this case in his head.
There were a couple of people from different Silicon Valley companies. One of them was Facebook, and the basic theme of what most of them said was like, you know, the Europeans are kind of cute with their privacy stuff, but if you don't play by the rules, nothing is going to happen anyway, so we more or less ignore what's happening.
So Schrems set out to investigate whether Facebook was indeed holding his personal information to Europe's stringent privacy standards. He requested all the data Facebook had on him, and after some struggle, finally received a CD by mail with more than 1,200 pages of information, 300 of which were supposedly deleted.
It actually says in their own database, deleted, but they keep it in the background, not really deleting it. And that was interesting because I was asking Facebook people why they were so stupid to send me all this evidence that they don't comply with the law. And the answer was that they had internal communications problems. So someone at Facebook was just stupid enough to forward it and bring it right to my doorstep.
Armed with evidence that Facebook was flouting European privacy laws, he complained to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, who regulates Facebook's European operations. 2 years later, when Edward Snowden revealed that the NSA could access European data held by U.S. companies, Schrems filed another complaint. This one went all the way to the European Court of Justice, which last week found that Europeans' fundamental rights to privacy were being breached.
We have data protection laws throughout Europe that every individual member state has to implement. If you could just, you know, move out data to a third country and do whatever you want to do with it, then it wouldn't make any sense to have privacy laws in Europe at all.
The court ruled that the 15-year-old Safe Harbor Agreement, whereby companies like Facebook and Google could easily transfer data from Europe to the U.S. if they respected Europe's rules, was not working. The agreement was null and void. U.S. companies now will have to prove they're complying with European law. Schrems told us that the ruling underscores the conflict between the U.S. and the European view of privacy.
Basically, Europe has a law where even just storing information and collecting information about another person is already a violation of his privacy. While in the U.S., there's generally the approach that only a misuse of the data can probably get you into trouble. So there's a much wider scope in Europe of protection, mainly because the argument goes that if you know that someone is watching you, you're already changing your behavior. That also kind of interferes with your freedom of speech, because if you know that everything you're saying is tracked, you probably don't say what you want to say. So there's a much broader protection than the Fourth Amendment in the U.S.
There was another distinction that you've made between the U.S. and Europe that I thought was particularly interesting. And that is, there's a presumption in Europe that privacy is a right equivalent to free speech. But in the U.S., consumers are asked to read companies' incredibly long and turgid terms of service and then make a decision, all or nothing.
I don't think even the lawyers that wrote all these privacy policies have a rough idea of what's going on the servers. So how should an average person understand that just wants to share a couple of pictures? So the approach in Europe is really to regulate these things by law and not leave it up to the individual consumers.
Some suggest that it's the sort of libertarian politics of Silicon Valley that says, you read it, you sign it, it's up to you, we don't need government taking care of this. as opposed to food safety, where, you know, the government is supposed to inspect?
Sounds nice that consumers should make an educated decision, but the reality is if we would have to educate people about food safety, building safety, fire safety, online safety, whatever, we would have to educate them 24 hours, 7 days a week, and they would still not understand it all. So in a developed society, in a developed democracy, these things have to be outsourced to specialists that take care of it. And we also need solid laws where we know what's legal and what's not.
How have you dealt with being the poster boy for this campaign? Do you find it ironic that you've been championing a case about internet privacy and it's made you internet famous?
Yeah, that's kind of the strangest thing about the whole case. From the beginning on, I was like, please don't put my name anywhere and don't put my pictures anywhere. And now, after the case last week, my picture was on the front page of every large European newspaper. But that's how the media works to a certain extent. Privacy is just a very complicated topic. So you need to have the one guy and you need to have the David versus Goliath story to go with it to even be able to sell the issue. So I think that you don't take things too serious.
Well, since you mentioned David and Goliath, I'm wondering if you're aiming at anyone else.
Not currently. I think in the long run, what we need in Europe is collective enforcement. So it's fun to be like the one guy doing something. But all these consumer issues, for example, are typically taken care of by consumer rights organizations because the average consumer is not going to sue for illegal 10-cent fee or something, even though companies make millions with that. That's really something where we need collective redress and collective enforcement. I think that's the way to go forward. So we don't need probably 100 people with their slingshots, but more probably 10 people that do that on a professional basis.
Max, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Max Schrem is finishing up his PhD at the University of Vienna. So Schrem says that one little guy with a slingshot can only go so far in policing privacy laws. What's needed is collective enforcement. James Kinsella, a former Microsoft executive who now runs the European cloud services company Zettabox, sees in the European Court of Justice's ruling exactly that kind of large-scale action on the horizon.
And I think one of the reasons why the court has been so forceful in its decision is because it's anticipating what else is coming up. And what's coming up in the European Union at the moment is a thing called the General Data Protection Regulation. GDPR is on its way and will have a far greater impact on how private citizens think about their data and how companies are going to have to react.
So this is a shot across the bow.
I think it's a very good way to describe it. This is essentially saying no to the way things are operating now, and wake up, Americans, because there is a regulation coming that really will change the way we are all supposed to think about private citizens' data.
So what happens if these big companies choose to ignore what Europe does?
I don't think they're going to be honest. Let's face it, some of these companies have at least as many European customers as U.S. customers, and these aren't silly boys and girls running these companies. So I think they're going to begin to put in place some of the provisions of the General Data Protection Regulation. That includes a right to be forgotten, for example, a demand that companies know where their data is, several other principles that are core to the GDPR. Quite frankly, there should be some pressure on the U.S. government to come up with something that looks and feels like the GDPR for American citizens as well.
Of course, that isn't going to happen. The NSA has the right, under certain circumstances, to any of the data that's being stored in any of thousands of U.S. companies.
That's right. And the U.S. Congress has the authority to change how that's actually interpreted. If, in fact, those kinds of provisions aren't recognized by the U.S. government, then this is really going to be a tidal wave. The GDPR has a very powerful provision that says that, listen, company, wherever you are headquartered in the world, if you are actually serving European customers and you violate this new law, you could be liable for a penalty of between 2% and 5% of your global revenues. That is a very, very heavy stick.
Now, you work in this area. It always struck me that regulations on the internet are very nearly unenforceable.
These rules are definitely enforceable. Things are unenforceable if you simply cannot identify the violator. But more than ever, we can identify the violator, and more than ever, we can use data to say there has been a violation. The internet is a much less Wild West place in 2015 than it was when I developed my first web company more than 20 years ago. We're going to have to give the individual who uses the internet greater controls over how their personal and private information is used. This issue is really about sovereignty. That is, can you guarantee government that I actually elect? Can you guarantee that you're really protecting my rights? And if you're saying, no, we essentially give that up to somebody across the pond whom you don't elect and whose government you have no real influence over, that's not right. If the reverse were happening, I guarantee you the Americans wouldn't go quietly into the night on this.
And so the moral of this decision is, take that, America. There's a whole lot more coming down the pike.
That's one way to think about it. The other way is to say, wake up, America, and get engaged in the conversation about bringing greater sense to the way that companies deal with individuals' private data. Because the U.S. leads the cloud services market. It should be leading this debate. At the moment, it's following.
James, thank you very much.
My great pleasure.
James Kinsella is a former Microsoft exec who runs the European cloud services company Zettavox.
Coming up, a requiem for a rite of passage, the Playboy Playmate.
This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Playboy dropped, well, a bombshell.
If you read Playboy for the articles, good news. You got to be less distracted than ever. The magazine is covering up. Finally, no more nudes. What a relief. Others are upset.
Yes, according to the New York Times, the magazine's circulation had plummeted from its peak of 5.6 million 40 years ago to about 800,000 this year. But the decision to cut the nudity from print starting March of next year seems almost counterintuitive. After all, doesn't sex sell? Well, not lately. When Playboy revamped its website last year and made it safe for perusal at work, its web traffic nearly quadrupled from 4 million monthly users to 16 million, and the average age dropped from 47 to just over 30. So there may be some market value in that decision, but it's perplexing and, I don't know, maybe a wee bit sad. The nation's mid-century mode of transgression is fading into history with the generation that birthed it, like Burma Shave and Network News. Diane Hansen is the sexy book editor at Toshin Publishing and the author of a 6-volume history of men's magazines. She says that Playboy did not exactly pioneer the titillating genre.
The first real men's magazine in America started in 1919, was Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. It was named after a World War I bomb. These were bombshells and just had little line drawings of flappers. It progressed into the 20s, and the 20s was a very liberal period. There was a magazine called Sex Magazine. It had nude women in there. There was also a lot of sexual experimentation that went on during the 20s. In the 1930s, right around the time that Prohibition was repealed, they decided to clean up the magazines. like, okay, they're going to go back to drinking. We can't have two vices going on. So we're going to get all these dirty magazines off the stands. And at that point, magazines went to just text. Inside were spicy fiction. And on the outside were beautiful painted pinup covers. Into the 40s, people went off to war. And even going back to World War I, there were high VD rates. What are we going to do? How are we going to keep these guys from becoming incapable of fighting by being laid low with VD? And the U.S. government got the idea, well, maybe if we give them pinups and magazines and something to keep their little hands busy. So suddenly, girly magazines were very popular. They weren't nude, but the magazines had photographs of women dressed in lingerie, dressed in bathing suits, and much more voluptuous women. And when the guys got out of the war after this barrage of pinups, they were kind of missing it all.
And is that where Heff comes in?
So you have Hugh Hefner, who served his time in World War II sitting behind a desk stateside because he had writing ability. His favorite magazine and every enlisted man's favorite magazine was Esquire, where you had pinups by George Petty and Alberto Vargas.
Ah, Vargas, who went on to a long career at Playboy.
Exactly. Hugh Hefner loved Vargas, but he wanted to see real women in the magazine that looked like these Vargas girls, and he came up with Playboy. There were other very popular magazines that had nudity, Modern Man being the biggest competitor, a very well-made magazine. What made Playboy so different than the other magazines of the time was that Modern Man was rough, tough, guys involved in tough, manly physical activities. And Hefner, who was the kind of man who wanted to lounge around his little apartment listening to jazz in silk charmeuse pajamas, whipping up cocktails, making some hors d'oeuvres, he's going to make a magazine for the urban sophisticate. And as he said in his first issue, we're not going to be out tramping around in the woods. We're going to spend most of our time indoors and invite in a female friend to discuss lofty intellectual matters.
And it was an attempt to incorporate in a positive way a sexuality into the rest of the kinds of interests that a person spends their time on when they're not working.
I spoke to Hefner 12 years ago when Playboy turned 50.
Our notion of playing hard was largely bowling and watching television, and there was more to life than that.
But Playboy's tastes were so expensive. I mean, wasn't the Playboy philosophy therefore a little exclusive?
Some of the dreams and some of the gadgets were out of reach, but part of the magazine, both its sexuality and also related to consumerism, was a fantasy. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for? It's a motivation to dream.
In the Playboy philosophy, you quote from one of your most eloquent critics, Harvey Cox. Can I read you his quote?
Sure, of course.
Moralistic criticisms of Playboy fail because its anti-moralism is one of the few places in which Playboy is right. Thus, any theological critique of Playboy that focuses on its lewdness will misfire completely. Playboy and its less successful imitators are not sex magazines at all. They dilute and dissipate authentic sexuality by reducing it to an accessory, by keeping it at a safe distance. And he concludes with, "We must see in Playboy the latest and slickest episode in man's continuing refusal to be fully human."
Well, I think that's very sophisticated semantics, but far from being accessories, the romantic relationship between the sexes, expressed from a male point of view, is what Playboy is all about. It's what makes the world go around. The fine food and wine and the clothes and the cars and the gadgetry, those are the accessories. But the part that really matters is the connection between the opposite sex.
Here's a clip that we borrowed from your A&E biography. It's you being challenged by feminist Susan Brownmiller on the Dick Cavett Show. And we'll run that now.
The role that you have selected for women is degrading to women because you choose to see women as sex objects. You make them look like animals, yes. Women aren't bunnies. They're not rabbits. They're human beings. The day that you are willing to come out here with a cottontail attached to your rear end.
We've been accused, obviously, of exploiting women, exploiting sex. I think Playboy exploits sex You know, I just think exploit is an unfortunate word. Playboy exploits sex like Sports Illustrated exploits sports.
Now, I noticed that you never responded to her specific challenge about the bunny tails. I mean, it would, after all, be antithetical to the Playboy aesthetic to attach a little fuzzy ball of cotton to your own tush, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so.
But is that fair?
And that feminist diatribe didn't make a lot of sense back then. It seems very foolish today. And quite frankly, was anti-revolutionary even at the time. To be truly human, women have to embrace their sexuality. And that's all Playboy's really all about.
Back in the early days when you were creating that costume and that image, it wasn't women expressing their own sexuality. It was women putting on the costume that you had designed for them. This wasn't them embracing their own sexuality. This was them embracing yours.
True. That's what makes it work.
Hefner had the genius idea to get the girl next door. And it's an idea that we don't understand quite as well today how forbidden this was.
Sexy book editor Diane Hansen. She says most men's mags, like Modern Man, usually featured girls that were, well, available, often strippers or prostitutes. They were naughty girls, not necessarily beautiful girls. Hefner directed his acquisitive gaze elsewhere.
The nice girl who worked in the office with you, who you had grown up next door to, who you went to high school with, who didn't wear a lot of makeup, that this girl you might get to see naked, this was just a revolution. Nobody had done this before.
As Hannibal Lecter famously said, you covet what you see every day.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Making something that allowed the ordinary guy, the guy who didn't have muscles, who wasn't brave, the fantasy of being able to get women and be cool just by using his mind and by learning how to cook, how to mix drinks, how to buy the right objects. It was very consumerist. It just appealed to a wide, wide audience.
Well, then let's talk about Penthouse and Hustler. Both were created to compete with Playboy.
Soon as Playboy sales took off, all the other men's magazines in America started copying the Playboy formula. They all got articles and drink recipes and toned down the look of their girls. But the more assertive guys, like Bob Guccione, he said, I see what Playboy is missing. I think that there are guys who want something that's a little more edgy, and they want to see girls who are a little spicier than the girl next door, not the old prostitutes and strippers, but maybe newer, better, younger, cuter prostitutes and strippers. So he came out with his magazine in England first, and in 1970, Penthouse arrived in America, and the first thing he did is he showed a little bit of pubic hair.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like the Rolling Stones versus the Beatles.
It was a lot like that.
Should I bring in Larry Flint's Hustler at this point?
Well, Larry Flint, you know, good old boy Larry Flint, growing up in the hills of Kentucky, saw that there was a big group of American men who were never going to make it to the Penthouse, who were never going to be playboys, who were going to get married, you know, in high school and have a couple of kids and get a job down at the auto shop, and that they needed a different kind of magazine. And he came out with this rustic, down-home, kind of Southern and Midwest-inflected, dirtier magazine.
Now, when all these magazines were confronted with the ready availability of video and internet pornography, Penthouse and Hustler became more explicit.
You know, the magazines survived video. They didn't really hurt sales. What hurt sales was the internet, because the day your magazine hit the newsstand, people would go scan every page, put it online for free.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1997, all the magazines started to see a 10% per year drop in their sales. When Penthouse saw this, because Guccione was very technology-oriented, he said, what does the internet offer? It offers hardcore. And he took his magazine hardcore and managed to get it on the newsstands and was not arrested. All the other magazines followed after, except for Playboy.
Now, the CEO of Playboy, Scott Flanders, told the New York Times this week that you're now one click away from every sex act imaginable for free, so it's passé. I wonder how you see Playboy's formulation that sex won't sell magazines anymore, but long-form journalism could.
I see it the same way they describe a good marriage. In a good marriage, sex is only 20% of the equation. And yet, if you take that 20% out of the marriage is dead. People really don't buy Playboy as a masturbatory agent. But that 20% nudity is what made it Playboy in the minds of people. If you take that out, it's a different entity, and I don't see how it can survive. I'll tell you what happened to Penthouse. When they put in the hardcore, they lost their audience who liked Penthouse as it was, and their sales dropped precipitously. Sexy pictures are not passé. What is passé is men paying for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real problem. That's what the internet did.
Well, what about the Playboy brand? By taking the nude pictorials out of the magazine, it can now be sold in places like China, where anti-porn laws crack down on the sales of magazines with naked pictures.
That Playboy bunny, the Playboy brand, was always something that described a certain quality. You know, it is women who want to wear Playboy branded things because by taking on the bunny, it makes her look sexy. The brand's associated with sex. I don't know what the brand would mean without the sex. Does it mean great interviews? Look at me, I've got a bunny on my t-shirt. Bunnies really know how to conduct interviews. It kind of guts the brand.
If this turns out to be a requiem for the centerfold, let's recall that it used to be a kind of rite of passage for boys and for girls. So now there'll be no more caches of nude magazines under the mattress or in the bottom of your father's drawers. Do you have a first memory of an encounter with Playboy's centerfold?
I was actually first shown a Playboy by my father. My father was a lifelong subscriber to Playboy, and so he showed me things in Playboy every once in a while.
Naked pictures?
No, he wasn't showing me the naked pictures. He would show me an article, or he'd show me cartoons, and I'd say, what is this magazine? And I'd want to turn pages. Oh, don't turn those pages! And, you know, and I'd turn a page and see a naked woman. Oh, it's Playboy. My father loved Hugh Hefner, and he died, in fact, in silk pajamas and a velvet robe.
So how do you feel about this, the passing of nudity from Playboy?
Oh, for years, I thoroughly enjoyed Playboy. It was a part of my life. For the past at least 5 years, I have not gotten Playboy because it had already passed out of relevance to me. You know, I made my peace with that. Really, it's already dead.
Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Diane Hansen is the sexy book editor for Taschen Publishing, the author of The History of the Men's Magazine, and the former editor of Puritan, Lake Show, and Jugs. The Playboy pictorial was revolutionary, not just in the kind of woman depicted, but how she was depicted. The spreads offered questionnaires and profiles of the women, their names and bios, likes and dislikes. They were accorded a kind of individuality, or at least a semblance of it. I asked Hef, can you say anything about how the image of the Playboy bunny has evolved? I mean, does she still find walks on the beach a turn-on and mean people a turn-off?
Probably. Some things in terms of humankind don't change that much.
Jim Schachter, WNYC's vice president for news, offers this recollection of his first brush with a Playboy playmate, Miss July, 1967.
My parents owned a women's clothing store in Glendale, California, suburb of Los Angeles. And when I was 7 years old, this young woman who worked as a sales clerk was going to be the playmate of the month, and that Playboy was going to come to J. Ross to take photographs of her clothed, which would be part of her photo shoot. Her made-up name was Heather Ryan. She was described, as I recall it, as a co-ed, and it told the story of how she lived in an apartment high in the hills, Heather and her pet ocelot. As I recall, there may even have been a photo of her in the hills with an ocelot on a leash. But number one, I know because I remember talking to her, that she did not have a pet ocelot. And I'm pretty sure it was not legal to have a pet ocelot in the city limits. Now, I remember other things about her, too. She was beautiful.
He's right. She was beautiful. And she did not have a pet ocelot. We spoke with Heather Ryan, and it was her friend's ocelot.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland, Joel Werner, and Dasha Litsitsina. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Matt Fiddler.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.